Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
The second captain's
world service.
And I said, I want to win the league, but I want to win it better. You can understand that, can't you?
Yes.
Good lad.
So he's almost like having a second captain in the team.
Second captain, first captain, whatever.
Josh van der Vleer said all the right things about being crowned World Rugby Player of the Year last night, crediting others for his award, pointing out this is really one for the team and all that stuff. But nowhere in his remarks did I hear him thank the people who were really responsible for making this happen. The Irish television co-commentators who make it. I'm thinking Donal Lennon, I'm thinking Alan Quinlan, maybe going all the way back to Ralph Keyes.
Ralph Keyes, throw it back to the OG.
Who have made it such a point of principle to always pick back rowers as player of the match that the idea of choosing van der Vleer over his teammate Johnny Sexton for the ultimate honour seemed like just the most logical thing in the world. What, you're going to give a flashy out half the World Player of the Year award again?
Nah. I'd love to have given it to you, Johnny, but unfortunately your number is higher than 8, so it's just not possible.
We've got a hard tackling, hard running, no nonsense back row there, and we're going to give it to him. Welcome to the show. Hey Murph, hey Si.
Hey lads, how are you?
Hello Owen, hello Simon, and congratulations Josh, congratulations.
As the person who first noticed this phenomenon, Murph, you must have also been pleased to note the identity of the player of the match against Australia.
Well, I'll tell you now, old. I was watching the game in the pub, and two separate people walked up to me and said, "You'll never guess who just won the match, Murph."
Yeah.
So there you go. Yeah. It's, well, listen, I mean, it's not
Van der Vleer, by the way.
It was
Caelan Doris.
Oh no, I mean, listen, the options are quite literally dizzying. You know, you could pick any one of three players. That's what makes the back row man of the match just so spicy. You know.
Yeah, well, congratulations to you as well, Murph, for being part of this push.
See, I have a bit of a theory about this. Mm-hmm. That basically,
I love the fact that people are coming up to the back to you. You see, Caelan Doris got mad at the match.
You always have to do, you know, because of that thing that I think.
I also think he did, a lot of the times they do deserve it.
He was clearly the best player.
But at the same time, it was just always going to regard as, especially,
I mean, I thought Gary Ringrose was pretty good. Yeah. I mean, actually, do you know what? I think Gary Ringrose generally is pretty bloody good
at
rugby.
He doesn't get as many Man of the Match or Player
of the Match awards. He's never won a Man of the Match. I can tell you right now, you'll look back through the records, Gary Ringrose has never won a Man of the Match award.
You know, Van der Vleer has won a Player of the Match award in 97% of the professional rugby matches he's played.
That's exactly it. It's like that stat about James Ryan, you know, where he won his first 25 professional rugby games. Josh van der Vleer, Man of the Match in his first 83 professional rugby games.
Jamie Heaslip was so mad to win a Man of the Match.
Yeah. It's a mark I don't expect to be passed. But
CJ Sander, I mean, the list goes on.
It was unbelievable. I do have a bit of a theory about this.
Yeah.
That basically there's, you know, there are like fads in sports, you know, where like Pep Guardiola became such a massive figure in world soccer that suddenly everyone had to be a midfielder. You know, like the apogee of the game was midfield schemer. You know, now I think it's just rugby has just decided a guy who can do a little bit of everything.
Yeah,
you know, in a highly specialized game, find you a guy who can do a little bit of everything, and that's where back rowers come in.
Well, there's
and
Gary 500 Ringrose. Rooks a game, and that's their job as well.
Yeah, though. And Gary Ringrose, by the way, who can do all of this, but is literally will never win a Man of the Match unless Gary, you fancy a little late career position change. I mean, I'm just saying, auxiliary flanker, anyone? It's no good being an auxiliary flanker, though. You have to be an actual flanker.
That's the point.
Actual,
yeah. So, yeah.
We have got an auxiliary flanker in his day, Gordon. Wasn't always Darcy and O'Driscoll were seen as our auxiliary flankers?
Yes. Yep.
Yeah. Well, Darcy's on today with Shane Horgan, who has
occasional flankers. They're your locks.
Yeah.
That's bit. They should rename all of the positions, given precedence to how often you behave like a flanker on the team.
Gordon on today with Shane Horgan, who has been covering the November internationals on Amazon Prime. A bit of a
Hugo Keenan, of course, a rare flanker. He's been a fine player for Ireland as well.
I've really got you started on the flanker thing. It's my own fault. It's my own fault.
Well, me up
need
enough.
To stop now, bro.
Gruder of a match against Australia on Saturday night to wrap up a series. Kieran, if you were to sum up Ireland's November series in five words, what would they be?
Played shite 1-3. Is that five words?
Simon, would you like to add a few more words to that?
Yeah, like I heard a few people saying, you know, it's no harm Ireland getting a bit of a shock here. We're getting too high on our horse ahead of the World Cup. I personally, and I think pretty much every Irish rugby fan, will never get too cocky. Like, if we go and win five World Cups in a row, I'll still feel like we're going to get knocked out in a quarterfinal because we essentially, that's our history, that's our DNA. That's kind of what we think is going to happen. It's the most likely thing to happen in the next World Cup. Mm. I don't think we needed a bad performance or a loss or anything like that to set us back on the right path. At the same time, I'm not too worried about us. I kind of feel like we figured out we can win without the ball now. We won with the ball against New Zealand. We're doughty, we're tough, we're resilient. But if we're going to do anything special, and we said this last week with Shane on the show, if we're actually going to do anything special, that phase play, that brilliant rugby that we saw against New Zealand, it doesn't need to be for the 80 minutes, but it needs to click at some point in a quarterfinal for us to make a
We also, just to go back over the three games, I would somewhat dispute Murph's really well thought out cogent argument there. Yeah. We played pretty well against South Africa.
We did. We did.
Didn't play. You're quite close to the bone on the next two matches, though, it is fair.
And if you think about the Mack Hansen try against South Africa, that's all the best things about Ireland. It's kind of like what New Zealand do as well, soak up the pressure and then score the try when you do get a chance. But I thought we were the worst of the three performances was against Australia. Mm-hmm. I think it's funny, Farrell seemed happier after this one than after the Fiji game. I think he loves when things go wrong. I think he wants as many things to go wrong as possible before the World Cup. Almost like trying to teach your child resilience. You know, will you guys fall apart if this situation happens? Or will you get used to the feeling of loads of things going wrong? Because it's loads of things are going to go wrong in the World Cup. By the time we get to a quarter, if we do make it, there'll have been several injuries. We'll be without one of our key players that we, you know, are a Furlong, a Porter, a Sexton. Even you'd say Hugo Keenan's kind of essential now.
Yeah.
Like there's quite a few positions where we think we've depth, but actually that was my main negative from the Autumn Internationals. We don't like the drop off even in back row to the next layer is a much bigger gap than we thought.
If you're looking for Ken Hardy's first report from the World Cup, that's available on the Football Podcast right now. And yep, it's a doozy.
It was a little bloodier than we thought. There was more blood spilt in the podcast than we expected.
It does feature a classic in the genre of Ken Hardy major tournament mishaps. That one is available to everyone. World Service members will, of course, hear more from Ken throughout the week and throughout the next few weeks about events on and off the pitch in Qatar. Our plan during the tournament is to record those World Cup pods every night after the final match and then put them out that night so they're available to listen to before you even put your head on the pillow each night. So that's the plan.
I know a lot of people might not listen that night, but you'll sleep easy knowing that it's there.
First thing in the morning.
You know, you can just...
There's a lot of people listen to podcasts late at night judging by the reaction we got.
Listen, might
have found a new niche in the market.
Yeah.
Midnight podcast.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
The Man of the Match report is solely distributed between the numbers 6, 7 and 8, no matter what goes on in the game.
But Keelan Dorris, the amount of work he went through, the amount of carries, brilliant footwork, scored that try, but he is my player of the match.
Kieran Murphy from second captain will be absolutely delighted. He loves the back row, man of the match. I'm sure he was shouting for Keelan Dorris, Murphy, you're listening there.
Now it's Porter. He'll pick it up and he'll try and drive through the tackle of Brady Retallick. They go to Sexton now. Arkey flings it wide. Keenan! James Lowe! James Lowe scores and Ireland take the lead.
They want more this afternoon and they got more.
All Blacks lining up on their own goal line. He's over! The hooker scores! Ronan Keller with the try. Simply sensational. Punching it up the middle. Here's the big run from Dorris. Keelan Dorris puts Ireland in front. Stunning try by Ireland.
Oh, what a moment.
Joey Carberry, born in Dargaville, the Irish parents.
He struck it pretty well, but it's over. Great kick from Joey Carberry, and Ireland lead again by 6. And there's just 2 minutes on the clock. Well, the All Blacks have it. Can they pull off another miraculous win? They've done it before in this very same stadium, but not today. It's not going to happen today. It's Ireland's. They get a penalty right in front.
Oh, it's Ireland's day.
A huge moment in the life of Joey Carberry. He can put it out of reach. Come the day, come the hour, and the glory will be with Ireland. They've been the better team right throughout. They'll put it into touch and fitting that James Lowe, who had the first say, has the last say. Famous victory again. Brilliant Ireland.
Back it goes to James Lowe. How kidding. But the man born in New Zealand kicks it out to seal an Irish victory.
The crowd have gone bananas here.
We've got a fair bit to get into this week with Shane Horgan. Hey, Shane.
How you doing?
Good, good. And Gordon Darcy in studio. Gordon, thanks for coming in.
Good morning, lads.
Let's start with the good news that came in overnight. Ireland has our third ever World Rugby Player of the Year after Keith Wood and Johnny Sexton. It is Josh van der Fleer, which is quite a stunning achievement for a guy who always had a fair bit about him, I think. But, I mean, the level of improvement from his early days to the point that he's World Rugby Player of the Year, would have surprised you 2 or 3 years ago, even if I told you that Josh van der Fleer is going to be the best rugby player in the world?
Am I surprised? Now that he has it, no. But I suppose if you go back those 3 years ago and say, listen, you will be World Player of the Year, it probably was hard to see an Irish player being one of them.
Is it the red scrum cap, Shane?
Yeah, listen, that's make yourself more visible on the pitch. Sometimes that can be a disadvantage, but if you're playing as well as him, it certainly highlights what you're doing. I think it's been a stratospheric rise over the last couple of years. I think he was always rated, regarded as a sort of diligent, hardworking player, but remember, it's only relatively recently that he's been 100% locked down as Ireland's open side. And in the last year, you know, we look at the teams that Ireland have beaten and look at the way they've beaten them, and his role in it, which has been integral to Ireland's best performances. And, you know, listen, if you look at Ireland's worst probably performance of the last couple of years is what we saw at the weekend, and it was because we were slightly inaccurate at the breakdown. That was a big component to it. So all the other elements of the game that we see with Ireland, it really starts and finishes with the breakdown, and he has given Ireland that clean ball, or being a big component in getting to the rooks first, cleaning out, securing, making sure the ball is fast for the halfback. So, you know, that's the influence that he's had on the Irish game and the Leinster game over the last, you know, probably 2 years, but in particularly the last year. I think it's a form decision, and go through the amount of man of the match performances he's had has been borderline ridiculous in that time. So well deserved, I think. But kind of an unusual selection in that if you look at the players that have done it before for Ireland, you think Keith Wood and Sexton are iconic over a number of, you know, sort of almost over their whole career, or certainly not far off. They built and built and built, and were at that top level for a really long time. Someone like Brian O'Driscoll, you know, never having won it. bizarre, you know, not to have that standout year. This is slightly different. It's somebody who's, you know, he may have many more and hopefully many more stellar years that he's up there in the running, but he hasn't been up there in the running year after year, but has had this, you know, incredible explosive 18 months. And you got to say, you know, well-deserved. The most consistent, maybe one of the, if not two key players in the team that's number one in the world and has won all but one of their games this year, I think, you know, it's hard to build a case against it.
We've successfully avoided talking about Saturday night's matchup to this point, Shane, so let's get into it now.
Do we have to?
Not the world's greatest spectacle, but with that longer-term view in mind, will there have been lessons learned?
I'm going to say that result is not, long term, is not a bad result for Ireland. I'm trying to look at the positive sort of. The performance was bad. There's no doubt about it. But, you know, we could have lost the game and we didn't. I don't think that anybody who played that game or anybody who coached that game is thinking everything's great and we're on exactly the path we want to be, and you know, there's not a huge amount of work to be done and refocus to be done in time for the Six Nations. So there may be a benefit if it was a slightly better performance. You know, maybe there wouldn't be as much scrutiny from, you know, from the commentariat. But I also think that this group of players and coaches are very able to analyze a performance, and they don't sugarcoat a bad performance. Andy Farrell didn't sugarcoat a bad performance last week, and I think it'll be similar. So while they've maintained maintained their record, while they've done the three-peat against Australia, you know, they've got away with a performance, they'll recognise that if they're slightly off, that, you know, they are likely to lose against any sort of a better side. That was a very poor performance by Australia as well. I expected much, much more from them. I thought they were very, very disappointing. The other bonuses that we can look at over this series is that, so Jimmy O'Brien has come in, I think done extremely well. We've seen he's sort of a test performer in that he went in against South Africa and you know, all practically started at 13. He played so much of the time there. I think we can have more time with Balakoon. Unfortunately, that's probably one of the things that didn't work. But, you know, Jimmy O'Brien, yes. I think to a degree, Stuart McCluskey has worked as well, or certainly looks as if that he's comfortable and does a lot of the right things. And I would feel, you know, very comfortable with him starting in a Six Nations game or a World Cup game, no problem. And then there's you know, Crowley, who came in, and I don't think he'll thank his pack for the performance. He could have, you know, had a lot of an easier ride. He could have shown more of himself. But under the circumstances that were presented to him, I thought we saw I think we saw enough moments to think this guy has got, you know, a future for Ireland ahead of him. So. You know, definite bonuses to be taken from it, and but, you know, in terms of the actual game itself, not great.
There's a lot in that one, Shane. I think it's probably a bit harsh on the match. Like, obviously, it wasn't a match for the ages, but like the defense from both teams was pretty good, and I think you're looking at it the way Australia defend, and I think we haven't played a team like Australia. They stay in defensive points an awful lot longer. So I don't necessarily think that was down to bad play by Ireland. I think
what do you mean they stay in defensive points?
So, like, as you know, when Ireland play that multi-phase game, they play that quick ruck, and it looks like the defence kind of evaporate, or they just run out of numbers, and we look brilliant. Australia are very good at staying in those long phase passage of plays, even with quick ruck, and a lot of the time they don't put too many players into the breakdown. So it keeps more numbers on the, on their feet. I think the challenge Ireland had was they didn't identify that regularly enough and try to do something a little bit different. Because we're usually reliant on Sexton or something to see that and to try and go, okay, well, we need to be a little bit different. But I think that was useful for Ireland to go, you know, you can't just win with playing this super quick game because teams are going to try and slow that down, and Australia did that for large periods.
So our team's starting to work us out then, is that the problem?
Yeah, but like that's what happens. We were kind of talking about this before we came on air, and it was like, you know, loads of teams have ways to, when New Zealand were at their pomp, you know, the Richie McCall, Dan Carter era, you know, you'd stop them in one place, you know, you might go after their set piece or you might go after something else, but they'd just focus on counterattack, or they would go to a kicking game, or they would show a kicking game and attack somewhere else. So I think that has to be the next evolution for this group and for someone like Crowley and Gibson Park. I don't think they, as you know, Shane is saying, like the pack, it's not, I don't think the pack was necessarily having a poor game. They were being well matched. Mm-hmm. I think there's two different things. Like a lot of lineouts, there was a big forward effort. There was a big the big focus on set piece and you know, James Ryan, I thought, led well in quite a tactical game from a set piece perspective. But when the game we did get some opportunity to play ball, I think Crowley and Gibson Park were very conservative in how they played.
Understandably, given that Crowley has just found out 20 minutes before the game he's about to make his international debut.
Yeah, his first start. But like, I don't know what you think, Shane, but I think that's probably the best way he possibly could have had his start.
Yeah, understandable for Crowley, but not for Gibson Park. I thought
Gibson Park is trying to take some of the heat off Crowley, so he's not going to use
it. Yeah, but in a really strange way, I thought, over the weekend, Shane. I thought Gibson Park had a bizarre game. His decision-making was all over the place.
Yeah, I think it sometimes happens when you have someone new in. Like, there's such respect for Sexton. We even saw it last week when I mentioned it, but Mac Hansen was kind of shrugging off Crowley. He was telling him to hold the short side wing, and he was coming in into the, you know, the keep on going, as we'd say, around the corner, which was the wrong decision. We saw Gibson Park maybe taking a little bit too much on, or making decisions that you wouldn't expect him to make over the last couple of weeks, maybe because Johnny Sexton wasn't there. But I do think, Darce, I don't really see it as you saw it, in that like the breakdown I thought was poor from Ireland, and the idea of playing multi-phase with quick ball only works if you're extremely accurate at the breakdown. And even guys who have had an incredible season, and I can't think, you know, speak more highly of Tadhg Byrne than, you know, I have done over the last few months, but he was a little bit inaccurate at breakdown. Even Josh Van der Fleer, a little bit inaccurate at breakdown. Penalties given away.
I don't disagree with you on that. But I don't think you're giving enough credit to the Australian, not necessarily their defence, but their tackling, I thought was very, very good. So part of that, like, there's two dogs at the bowl. I do think Australia's defence and their tackling was very, very good, and that contributed quite heavily towards the inaccuracy that Ireland had at the breakdown. And I'd say you're absolutely right with Tadhg Byrne. And I'd say they're questioning the decision of him playing 80 minutes last week and Shepherd hooking Kieran Treadwell, because he's one of those players that definitely create something. He was getting some turnovers and everything, but his energy around the field wasn't there. And they do rely on him as that kind of that little link play between the pack and the backs.
And I'm not saying that, you know, Australia are entirely passive in this area, but I thought it was more on the Ireland side, and I think that Ireland it was sloppy. It was sloppy.
The amount of times we were told to roll away and didn't roll away, for example.
Yeah, but that is just not being smart as well, or maybe it's a little bit fatigue. I don't know what it was, but we weren't definitely as accurate, and then that made everything more difficult. That means that, you know, the slow ball, you know, there are more Australians get back up on their feet, and then that does make things more difficult to be sort of incisive around. But there was more than that. Our exit plays were poor. We overplayed. We didn't, and we made mistakes that even when we did the first bit right, and there was a great example where we had a line out in the second half, sort of deep in our 22, and it was a really good line out, and then carried by Doris, got into a really good space, and then we sort of turned it over, and then all of a sudden Australia are back, and Australia played a lot of territory, deep in our area, and our exits just weren't good enough. In the air, we were very, very poor. Our kicking game was poor, and our kick to regather game was
really
poor.
We have been
really
for a while with that as well. We've been considering when you think and just watching Rob Kearney just talking about the Nick White thing, and you're just kind of thinking back to we could rely on him, and obviously Shane yourself at various points. It used to be such a strong part of the Irish game.
Matt Canson should be quite good at that, because sometimes he takes the offensive ones very well.
Yeah, it's just not something we go to very often.
Yeah, he's but only honestly he's taken. I thought he took one really good ball all series, Mike Hansen. And this is an area that will lose us test matches. I mean, listen, if we don't address this, and it's going to be an area that is going to be a selection issue, because teams will have identified this now, and that's the problem. It's like the scrum. If you get a reputation for having a weak scrum, everyone goes after the scrum, referees are looking for it, and it puts more pressure on. If you get a reputation for not being good under high ball, people start firing high balls on you. Unless you have a series of very good performances, then you're the guy who isn't great under the high ball, or you're the Irish team that can be exploited under the high ball, and then you just receive more of them. It's going to be a tactic in the Six Nations. There's no shadow of a doubt about it. And I thought for each of the back three, and then include Balakun into that, none of them performed well in the air. And unless they tighten that up, either someone's going to lose their place or Ireland are going to lose tests.
And Shane, just judging Crowley on that match, Ireland had, 33% possession in that first half, most of it in their own 22. It's some people are criticising, which I just don't get, because there was no real platform there for a guy who had 20 minutes notice before he came onto the field, would have had very few experiences of just running. I think he's played something like 20 minutes as well with Stu McCloskey outside him. Gibson Park inside him didn't have a good game. The pack didn't have a good game. The ruck was a mess. So do you judge, or what did you...
We did win the game.
How do you rate Jack Crowley? With Australia playing really badly, I think we need to bear that in mind. I thought Australia were...
I do thought, and Doris, we did win the game, but I think this is a different team. This is the world's, the number one team in the world who's won a series in New Zealand, who beat all comers aside from France last year, and who, I think are really justify that position. The only question you could have is, France on any given day between the two, what's the difference? And I think it's tight, and we will find out where we are with regard to that in the Six Nations. So the bar is definitely higher for this team than, it's higher for this team than any other Irish team probably in history because of what they've achieved. So, just getting, scraping a win with a bad performance against, I think, a bad, tired, and against an Aussie team who's had its worst run in its history as well. We have to, look at it in that context. But on the Crowley point, listen, this guy should be getting no criticism. I wrote it down. I think, has he got 20 senior games?
Yes, like, something like that.
So unbelievable. And a 10 who needs games. And you look at, someone like Sexton, the amount of games that he played before he got anywhere near an Irish, before he got anywhere near a Leinster team. He played a lot of games. There was a long apprenticeship before, he took over. But what I like about Crowley is, one, he didn't shirk his responsibility in there. He did the thing that is most difficult at international level, is to run flat. And I thought he remained a threat almost throughout the game, even though he wasn't getting the ball that allowed him to be as big a threat. But he got into that space where he was pulling and attracting defenders to him. And it is vital for a 10 to do that, and just really encouraging that he could do it. Will he be able to develop loads of different elements of his game? Yes, he will. But as long as he retains that, for the way that Ireland played, it's the most important thing for him. So I thought, really good. I thought not too many flaws in his game, although not a perfect game, of course, it wouldn't be, but I would have loved to have seen him with the forwards the performing slightly better and giving him a bit more platform, because we did see that we saw a bit of the loop play going, both just for the backs and then for the forwards and the backs interacting with each other. And we saw a bit of the secondary, but I actually think he would thrive in that Ireland game when they do have quick ball and they have forwards and backs interacting and he's getting second and third touches. I was really encouraged by it. You know, listen, he needs more game time. I think it might be an indicator that he will get more game time in Munster. That could be a very difficult situation for Joey Carberry. But I would like to see him play more, and he's in very good position to be number two for Ireland going into the Six Nations.
What about yourself on his performance and where he's at?
I think it would be unfair to not give him the same level of scrutiny as you're giving everybody else. Some people, like, he's been fast tracked. He doesn't have a huge amount of games under his belt. But if you're going to be fast tracked, you've got to be a fast learner as well. I thought he was fine, I'll be honest. I think the stuff that Shane is saying there absolutely didn't shirk his responsibility. I felt the team tried to protect him, or players around him tried to protect him too much. McCluskey didn't do enough for him, in the sense that sometimes, as in that position, either him or Ringrose needed to just go, we just need to get over the gain line here. I can get, just give me the ball, I'll get over the gain line, and we'll at least get you one quick ruck and you can have a look and see what, and have, get him that front foot ball where he's moving. Too often he was static and then having to generate momentum, and that's when we looked quite, easy to defend.
I felt like we needed to just stop and have a reset, almost like gather in for a second, one direct ball, McCloskey, and then one fast ruck. Like, really focus on
there's a whole generation
ruck.
Of whiteboard rugby players that there's a psychological safety in doing what is on the game sheet. So if I don't make a mistake, I don't do anything wrong, but then you're not going to do anything different either. Yeah. So sometimes it needs to be, when defences are reading teams that are so, we're overly analysed, you do need somebody to throw a dummy and, carry, big Stu McCluskey, 6'2", 6'3", whatever he is, 100 plus kilos. Let's use physics here and find Bernard Foley and get over the gain line with as quick a ball as possible. And forget about getting into a diamond shape and everything and all that. Sometimes games like that need that. You mentioned players like Sean O'Brien and David Wallace and Brian and players. There's an art to reading a game as well, that sometimes a decision needs to be made that isn't on the thing, it hasn't been coached, it's up in your noodle, that you go, actually, this feels right and I back myself to make a strong decision here, which is getting over the gain line.
Which apparently they are empowered to do under Farrell. That's what we hear anyway.
Yeah, I think, but like, you remember, like, they haven't, towards the end of the previous way, it was so scripted.
Yeah.
You're now asking players to think again, and that is, you don't go from straight and everything is, now we think and everybody is thinking. There are still piano pushers and there are still piano players. We just need a few more players to be thinking. And with a guy with Crowley there, I think the experience around him didn't do enough for him in the game to be able to, for him to shine.
On
that, Darcy, I thought that even when we did, carry well, and I thought McCluskey did carry well a few times, Doris carried well a number of times, it was, and we were on a decent platform to maybe do something off it with faster ruck ball, with more Australians committed. It was in that ruck that we messed up, and it was, it was either slow or slowed up by, an Australian body, or we were inaccurate at the break, anything that happened. It was then, that ruck, and then that slows down, and then you get into that sort of, stagnant couple of phases, and then are you trying something and are forcing something? And that's why we ended up having all these phases between, I would say, our 40-meter line and our 22, and never really exiting the zone, for very, very long periods. So, it wasn't necessarily, I thought, just, playing through those phases, particularly from starter phase. It was, again, it came down to our issues at ruck time that, that weren't good enough.
Could I venture a very unfortunate frame of view? That was three really, really tough matches. but and the Fiji game was a lot tougher than we thought it was going to be, just purely because they were big men that liked to hit, and up until that red card were hitting very, very hard, and we struggled with that level of physicality. And and same against South Africa. We were tired going into that, and it was very clear there was bodies that were tired in that game, and there was new people introduced. And again, we're talking about this gap between who are our perceived first 20, 22 players or 18, 19 players and the next level in behind not being there. And we need to play seven games to at a very high level to be able to be able to perform. And you do wonder, is that this group's limit? Is this Irish rugby's limitation and not this group, as I'm saying, you know, we played the three matches on in New Zealand. But like, if we had another match the following week.
Yeah. No, the gap does seem to be bigger.
Right? It's worth thinking about. All right. What about the Nick White incident?
Just on that. I agree. I thought we looked fatigued.
We finally agreed on something, Shaggy.
Got there at the end.
I do. I thought we looked fatigued, and some of our players, and again, I hate pulling out Tadhg Byrne because I just thought he looked fatigued, but he's put in some serious shifts. You know,
his stomach bug as well a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, and took a bang. He broke his nose. You know, that actually takes it out of you as well. So, oof. Doris, I don't know whether.
Like Tadhg Byrne starting against Fiji, you're kind of going, and actually, ironically enough, he needed game time because he has absolutely no game coming into it. But you're kind of going, like, surely you're going to have to start Tom O'Toole or Finlay Beelam in one of those games. And why?
Maybe it's because he didn't have the games. You're right. And there was actually a number of people in a similar vein, wasn't there? You know, Peter O'Mahony didn't have a huge amount of game time going in, either the Tadhg. It's actually probably, and if you look at it, you know, it's probably the second and third week where that sort of maybe a little bit lacked of fitness manifests, not in the first one where you can get through the game almost, you know?
Nick White, guys, was removed from the field of play. He came back on, even though we heard the referee himself saying that he had seen him stumble. So he went off for his HIA, came back on. He has now been stood down for 12 days. This is after, if people didn't see it, there were a couple of different incidents, a couple of different knocks he took within the same fairly short period. This is what the Aussies are saying. Now, after initially being passed of his HIA by the independent match day doctor, Nick White's criteria 2 HIA, where a diagnosis was not immediately apparent, has been upgraded to a criteria 1 assessment, balance disturbance, post-match, and he'll serve a 12-day stand-down period. They do stress White was not exhibiting any symptoms of concussion post-match or the following day, which I don't actually fully understand that statement, because on the one hand they're saying he didn't have any symptoms, but on the other hand his HIA has been upgraded to show balance disturbance. Another wrinkle to this, Shane, is according to the Sydney Morning Herald, the independent matchday doctor may not have actually seen the second incident because he was involved in trying to ascertain the damage from the first one. And in some sort of mitigation to the Australian medical team and the independent matchday doctor, there was a lot going on in that game and even in those couple of minutes. But having said all that, what do you feel about what transpired there over those few minutes on Saturday?
I think they've missed it. I think it was clear to anyone who reviewed the footage that there wasn't just one knock, but two knocks, which I think in any of the research or opinion around this, you know, heightens the danger level really significantly, one knock after another. There's an issue. There's two issues here. There's one that we know about, that the HIA as it stands is not foolproof. There is then a level of sort of additionality that can be used if the players do pass the HIA, but we see images like we saw at the weekend for the first and the second knock, and the language that we heard from the referee, and how we saw him groggy and visibly groggy, and I thought unstable on his feet. That is built into the HIA process. It should be. And so the independent doctor can take that into account, even if he doesn't, even if he passes the HIA through the protocol, that the sort of physical protocol when he comes off the pitch. What seems to be the case, and there's been a couple of examples of this happen already, that the correct footage or the full extent of the footage around this injury wasn't presented to the independent doctor. So he wasn't fully informed of all the evidence before making the decision, which is based on the HIA and any of the visual or simply, let's call it, secondary information that forms his assessment of whether someone can go back on the pitch. There, that shows that there is an issue with the right type of information coming to the independent doctor, and then him being able to make the decision based on the totality of the evidence. I think that's the issue. We need to make sure that the HIA doctor, independent doctor, gets everything he needs to make these decisions. I'm not suggesting that's easy, because as you say, there's a lot going on. There's a lot of camera angles. There was a very stop-start game. There was a lot of injuries. It's difficult, but it's the most important thing in rugby. I have to say, I think it's the most important rugby. We can't afford these situations to happen again. And whatever I think there has to be a re-look at how we get information to this independent doctor, because the, even one missed opportunity is, or sort of, you know, one missed case, diagnosed case, could be, you know, catastrophic. So it has to change.
As Joe Molloy pointed out on TV, it shouldn't even have gone down to the HIA, World Rugby's guidelines on head injuries state a player should be immediately and permanently replaced if they display any criteria one symptoms of possible concussion, including balance disturbance, without an on-field assessment even needing to be carried out. But
yeah, and the ref, as I said,
what was the ref's wording, just to get that right? I saw him stumble as well. You hear the ref saying that on the mic as he's making sure that he's going off for a HIA.
I like
this. Does the ref not then have a he's obviously given a clear indicator.
He's an obligation that he's saying. Yeah.
He then has an obligation not to let that person back on the field.
Yeah, and I'd say, but I think as well, it was almost the full 10 minutes he was gone. So I'd say the ref just, and love, it's not funny, but he likely just forgot and then was like, oh, because I was surprised when he came back, when he was on. I was like, oh, you might go
for a ref to take
in
the game.
Oh, that's what I mean. It's too much for it. But that's what I was going to say is, there's other people who I think should or could shoulder some of that responsibility. So like there is a medical person beside Jake White when he's when he is on the ground, and you can see him. His eyes are lit. He's absolutely stunned, and you can see that from the on the camera. But there is an Aussie, either a physio, water carrier, somebody like that. You know, at some point, you have to protect. It's bizarre that you have to protect players from themselves, and that does mean you've got you have to stick your head above the parapet and just go, no, like lads, he is clearly stunned, and saying that to the doc, passing it on to the Australian doctor, who would then go at least saying, okay, passing information should be going down and going, nah. He shouldn't even be allowing him to do it.
It was as obvious to you guys, having played the game professionally, that guy looked like he was in trouble, right? Because there is this whole thing that we're not doctors and you're not a doctor, and you have to leave it to these guys.
Yeah, but like, there's also things, if you're going down that tunnel, there's a reason you're going down it. Mm. Really, like, is it not a contradiction in terms in saying, okay, well, I'm going to send you down to see if you look stunned. You are, so I'm going to send you down to do a quick test to see if you are stunned.
And the ref has said that he saw you stumble.
You know,
no, it did seem a particularly egregious case.
Stunned them first.
Yeah.
If you're going down, if you've a question for a HIA, should you be coming back? I don't really think you should be, to be honest.
I'm still amazed.
But that's the rules. That's the rules. You know, if there's any sort of question at all, then what you've seen visibly on the field. You know, if there's something visibly on the field that you can see where there's potential that is a concussive, a blow, then actually, you know, the HIA is not even something that should be undertaken. You know, if that visually can be seen, then, you know, the player should stay off. But there's a couple of things. I think on this, complete deference to the medics here is, I think it comes from a position which I think is possibly a good one, in that, you know, for too long, medics were, you know, the opinion was sort of disregarded almost, because you had these coaches coming in and the coaches say, oh, he's fine, or the player would say he's fine. And that had to change, and it did change. But we also have to say, we know, and it's acknowledged by the medics, that the HIA isn't always conclusive or foolproof.
Yeah.
So, it's not right to then just hand over complete and have complete deference to the medics in these situations, yeah. Because you know we've seen with our eyes, you know, the referee stated it. I think if the independent doctor, and I hope this would be the case, if he was made fully aware of all the visuals that were around that incident, then there would be no debate here and he would have remained off. So is there another individual or individuals or team of individuals that are working specifically on providing that, you know, those independent medical doctor with the best information in order to make the decision? There seems to be a disconnect between what we're all seeing on the pitch. And I didn't see the second hit immediately, but I actually didn't see the first hit immediately. So the replay, I saw it. Then I saw the second one. Then I saw actually the way Nick White was acting. He looked shook, actually. He thought, oh, this is two bangs one after another. He didn't look great. You know,
Shaggy, we've erred too far on the side. So when we go back to when lads were stumbling, and I remember being in a room and I think it was Rob Kearney got up and he was like stumbled for like six steps sideways and we were all laughing because we didn't
know awareness of consequences. Yeah,
we didn't understand of what it is. And this was actually in a presentation and a doctor kind of said, so what's happened here, lads, is a neural pathway in that lad's head has been blocked. So the message for his foot put one front in the other has taken longer to go around, and that's why he's stumbling. So that neural pathway, he said, it's effectively like being the M50 being blocked. He said, that message, you know, you have to go around the long way. So it's pretty bloody serious what they're talking about here. So I think we were so far to the left on blasé about it, you know, get up, don't disrespect your mates, get up back in the line, and that was the type of approach. You're letting your mates down if you said you had a sore head. And now we're going, oh, well, we don't really want to take players out. We want to put this really vague kind of screening and we don't have all the information and players are slipping through the net to come back on. Like, why are we not going so far now to the right to go, if you wobble, you're rejected, you're out of the match.
Well, again, just on that, if you wobble, you are supposed to be gone. And this exactly. is the thing about trusting the science and trusting the doctors. We are trusting the science. We're trusting that it was doctors who came up with these guidelines. That's in the cold light of day as well, rather than in a really pressurized situation on the pitch when everyone's blood is up.
Which
and so
players
on.
Spend most of their time trying to get around.
Yeah, so the guidelines are there. We're just talking about that those guidelines should have been
it's
followed.
It's also brand new. This idea of a HIA has evolved. It's brand new anyway. And in that short space of time, it has evolved. So like you say, Shane, the idea that this new test that we've been trying for the last year or two, let's absolutely just go by that and nothing else, as opposed to 50,000 people plus a ref plus a teammates watching him wobble and still him coming back on.
Yeah, but the thing is, that's not the rule. We don't say, you know, as you said, the rule is broader than just the independent doctor HIA assessment, you know, number one, because we know there's a number two. We know there's it's broader than this. That information that everybody, I think, could see, you know, with their eyes and the referee directed to, that is meant to form part of the process and part of the decision-making process. So the issue is that the independent doctor saw that and disregarded it, which was an error, or, and I'd say more likely, wasn't presented with the full imagery of the two blows and
I think this looks really poor on the Australian team, to be honest. Like, it's just bizarre that
you can see how it happened as well, in that so there is an independent doctor there who's tasked with protecting the player and the safety of the player. When that decision is made to allow the player by an independent doctor back onto the field, you're right, Doris, it should have been picked up on the Australian side, because they
can't be the Irish guy, because then you're going, oh, you're just trying to get them off. You're trying to get them off.
The Australian guys had more information. I think they had more information. So you're right. But it would be, you know, and I don't know if this has happened before, it would be one doctor overruling the independent doctor in this position. So it is, you know, it becomes as kind of a trickier one. I think in the first instance, now this is solved by the providing the independent doctor with all the information that is necessary to enforce the rules.
If you're Dave Rennie and you're up in the box and you've heard the referee go, I've seen him stumble. You've seen him stumble. You've seen every one of those angles. Why not just sub him and go, like, I want him at a World Cup. So, like, there are ramifications.
I don't know for sure Rennie heard that or saw everything, but between, like, the physio, the doc, the ref, teammates, the management team,
just
somebody...
Just because the independent doctor goes, yeah, no, he's passed his HIA. Like, everybody with a set of eyes and a thing could see he shouldn't be coming back on.
Just to be clear as well, we're not in a position to say that, and we're not saying that medical information was deliberately withheld from the matchday doctor.
No, this is just so much going on,
and for whatever reason, he didn't seem to get the full picture. So it's something broke down somewhere along the way there. Anyway, just on New Zealand... England to finish up, Shane, and that unbelievable comeback from England, which could have been an even better comeback if they hadn't kicked the ball out of play in one of the most soul-crushing decisions that I've seen, albeit extremely logical decisions that I've seen in the rugby pitch, given where they were at. Were they right to just take the draw at that point?
I think it speaks to an issue.
Do you think it's a problem? Yeah.
I mean, they were well inside their own half.
They could get turned over.
I hate it. Even, like, was it last week as well? Again, I know it's very different circumstances, but against Fiji. And I think
Farrell picked up on it.
You know, I used to drive me demented when we were playing. You think any chance, even no matter how much you're up, the opportunity to go again, you know, and score a try, just speaks to the intent in a team. You know, this is not, you know, sort of a World Cup. You know, there was a chance to go after that game after potentially, I know the position wasn't great, but like the harness, the emotion, it probably speaks to a couple of things. One, that, you know, England haven't had a brilliant year. The Eddie Jones is under pressure. I don't know what was coming down from the stands, but it's, you know, it's likely maybe he was happy to take the draw under those circumstances, given where they were, you know, 20 minutes beforehand. But in other circumstances, I think it would have said a lot about the team to sort of go on, have a crack and recognize, yes, there was some jeopardy with potentially losing the game, but they're home, they're, you know, on the back of a momentous change in the game and an opportunity to, you know, to do something monumental, and they turned it down.
Hell of a comeback though, all the same.
Going around on the way up to do commentary and just looking at it, it's like, oh, brilliant, England getting stuffed again. And every time I got up, I was like, oh, it's 25-4. Well, same with Shaggy. You're just kind of going, it does also show that they've pretty much brought in the most attack-minded out half in probably the Northern Hemisphere, even more so than Finn Russell. And in... Marcus Smith,
yeah.
And they basically tied him up in strings and just gone, like, this is the system, this is what you're playing. So you've played brilliantly to get selected, and you play this unbelievable brand of rugby, and you're attacking first receiver, very much like Crowley, that type of a thing. Well, Crowley very much like him, maybe, probably the other way around. And he's just tied up in knots, and he was just sitting there going, oh yeah, I probably should kick this out. He's not playing off any sort of instinct, and England have not figured out what their 10, 12, 13 looks like.
I'll tell you the man who can sort that out, Gordon. Certain former teammate of yourself and Shane's, Ronan O'Gara, is reportedly on the ORFU's 3-man shortlist to succeed Eddie Jones as England
coach. Before the World Cup or
according
after?
To the Times, I presume. before the World Cup would be an absolute boulder. What do you think, Shane? Raj for England?
Well, I'm sure Shane will be as part of his backroom staff, I would have thought.
Yeah. Media liaison, what do you think? I think that if Ronan gets off the job, he'll take it. It's one of the biggest jobs in world rugby. I believe a man can order can live on a decent salary as well, the one that they provide. So I think you're in the world of professional coaching. That's what you do. There's no I don't see a sort of path in Ireland at the moment for him, and maybe not for a while. And that's, in some ways, it's disappointing, but other ways it's good, because it says it means that Ireland is in rude health. So I think he'd probably be all over if he gets the chance.
He can take the Andy Farrell, Stuart Lancaster path, fail with England, and then rejuvenate themselves in Irish rugby. It's gonna be perfect. Well done, O'Gara. He's thinking the long game, that guy always is. Gordon, great stuff. Thanks, Emil. Shane, brilliant. Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks a million, lads.
Owen, I like you and I like your style.
The second captain. We've got a bit better quality.
It's compliment any place, anywhere, all over the world.
Full of protein.
It's information, fluid information.
I don't know what you're talking about.
You can do it while you're cleaning the house, brushing your teeth, taking a bath.
Trying to be critical is going to be impossible.
We haven't actually mentioned the big result over the weekend. Georgia beating Wales in Cardiff. They also beat Italy in the summer. Mm. And now they're calling on World Rugby. They're basically saying World Rugby cannot ignore us any further and need to stick us in the Six
Nations. No can do, Georgia. Oh. Sorry. You're not a good enough holiday destination.
The Olympics.
Just watch us.
Fancy
says,
to as much.
Replies World Rugby.
Tough result for...
Some pictures of Rome back.
Yeah. A tough result for Wales to take. But if ever there was a time to suffer a shock defeat, perhaps this was the time. With the eyes of the nation now focused on their first appearance at a World Cup since 1958. They play the US tonight in the final game of today's schedule in the World Cup. That's at 7 o'clock our time. You're cheering for Cymru this evening, Ciarán?
God, Owen. Did we talk about this really briefly when it came out? But basically the FA of Wales released this video a couple of weeks ago of this folk singer called Dafydd Iwan singing a song called Imiaha Ohid, right?
Great pronunciation.
It means we're still here. Dafydd was jailed for defacing English-only signs across Wales in the 1970s. So he's massively into the Welsh language, the revival of the Welsh language, which has gone spectacularly for Wales and the Welsh language in the last 20 or 30 years. And the video could have been this kind of... Because the song is like is a protest song. So the video, as released by a football association, could easily have been, as Dafydd himself says, a sanitized, corporatized version of the song. Mm-hmm. But that's absolutely not what they did. It's spliced through with footage of the coal miner strikes. And it's basically the song was written in the 70s and 80s as kind of like an anti-Thatcher protest song. And the video is cut through with all of this like amazing imagery, unbelievable footage of miner strikes and... Welsh language protest.
You've sent it on to me. It really is so evocative. Yeah.
Now,
as well as the old footage of this, John Toshack hitting the crossbar and a key qualifier and these sorts of football bits.
And this would all be great on, even if the song wasn't an absolute stone cold banger, which is what it is.
Catchy.
It's unbelievably catchy. Now, I mean, you know, short old men singing about how much they hate the English is. You know, let's just say it's not entirely uncommon in my Spotify profile. So maybe there's something, you know, there's something in particular that I'm reacting to here. But I did have like a small cry at breakfast this morning, just like a small one. You know, like, what, 30, 45 seconds.
Your first World Cup cry.
Weeping openly. Yeah. And then you,
shoulders up and down kind of one?
Full on. Just I had to go for a little walk around the house to clear my eyeballs.
Your wife just took one look and slowly left for work without a word.
This is going to be a long month. But I mean... Yeah, bloody hell, Owen. It's got some balls. It's a hell of a tune.
Thanks, Murph. Will we play out with it?
Explains why you're wearing a daffodil suit now.
It is a long tune, so we'll leave it up to Simon how much we're going to play.
I personally would play all 4.5 minutes, mm-hmm. but I mean, I know that I'm in the minority there.
It's an amazing song.
It is absolutely
He cut Gangsta's Paradise short, so you're doing well too.
Imeha Ohid by Dafydd Iwan, Owen.
Lovely stuff. Thanks, Murph. Thanks, Si.
Thanks, lads.
Thank you, Simon. Thank you all.
Thanks so much for listening. Don't forget to sign up to the World Service for ad-free podcasts. And the Second Captain's Pod is part of the
Acast Creator Network.
Network. That was it.
Magnus Maximus o Gymru ar y flwyddyn 323 a'n gadair a'n genedd i'n gofod a heddiw
Felly fi yma o hi fi yma o hi er gweitha maw a phobeth er gweitha maw a phobeth er gweitha maw a phobeth fi yma o hi.
Good morning.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.